I think this is kind of a fool's effort to ban and censor Bitcoin from happening within the United States.
At the end of the day, like running a mining facility, it can be very difficult to make sure every machine's online.
Miners have since regained the trust of the overall Bitcoin community.
How is the mining network going to be sustained?
It becomes increasingly clear why there needs to be an alternative global financial system that's not dictated by a handful of people on Capitol Hill.
Thank you for coming on to the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me. I've been excited for this one.
Yeah, we ran into each other in Miami, and that was a lot of fun. And we're like, hey, you know, you've been on before. We got to get another episode going. So what's been new? What have you been up to with Luxor?
A lot of things. It's hard to keep track of. This is our third bear market we've been through, and we always try and put our heads down, build product during these types of markets. And so we've been busy on a few different product launches. Mainly hash rate derivatives, custom firmware, and an ASIC trading platform. Quite a few different product lines that we're excited to launch. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess if we want to start with the first one, how's the hash rate product coming along? I mean, I feel like it's still kind of like an open type of market in that arena. It's not like there's like a one go-to company that like everyone knows about yet. So yeah, I'd be curious as to like what it is you guys are focusing on, how you're approaching it, how that building's going.
Our view on the space is that hash rate itself will be treated as a commodity in the future. And so naturally, that commodity will have things like a derivatives market to support it. And so our thoughts are that there'll be lots of different companies and participants in the space offering variety of different derivative products, something like a physically delivered forward contract to, you know, a cash settled swap or you know, based on the value of hash rate versus based on network difficulty. Yeah, a wide kind of menu for miners to choose from at different times. And also for traders to kind of go in between these different platforms to arbitrage it, as well as to offload certain risks on their own trade. So that's how we view the ecosystem developing moving forward. It's still very nascent. We've been saying the same thing for the past 3-4 years, but I think it has progressed a long way. Lots of companies looking at the space, and this past downturn in mining economics that we saw in the past 6 months, it has really highlighted the need for miners to be able to offload some of that risk onto other parties and really hedge their operations. So overall, we're excited about the space, but I think it's going to be a long journey here ahead of us.
Yeah, I mean, like what you're talking about right now just sounds like that next evolution, right? Like back in 2018 or so, a lot of the infrastructure that you have today, just the abilities as a miner in terms of like borrowing, lending, trying to hedge your risk, it's evolved, but I feel like the hash rate side of things is that next evolution that people are still looking at. So let's say that you're a miner and you want to start utilizing some of these types of products. Is this something that's live right now that customers can interact with? Or is this something that, you know, is going to be like launched at some point in the future for customers?
There's a few different products that exist in the market already. None of them, as you kind of alluded to before, have kind of claimed the top spot as a very liquid and tradable asset. And so certainly there's not a lot of great products out there, but there is starting to be more, including our new contract that's coming out. We're in beta mode right now, so we are trading it with a few different participants, both miners, traders, family offices, and those types of profiles. But as of now, there's no kind of liquid market that you see, you know, thousands of petahash trading per day. And so that comes with some drawbacks, especially as a miner right now. If there's not a lot of potential buyers in the space, that usually leads to a very expensive hedge for you. And miners typically choose no hedge versus an expensive hedge. And so figuring out that buy side and building up volume in these products is crucial to them becoming valuable for the miners as a, you know, risk mitigator.
Yeah. I mean, in the long term, how do you see this evolve? Like, because of course, when you're building out this product, testing it, you guys, it sounds like you're doing the right thing. You're going and you're testing it with a select group, making sure that it's working. So by the time that you actually announce it and launch it, then you've worked out all the kinks. So how do you kind of see this evolving, right? Because one of the things that, and I'm just kind of thinking through this with you right now, but one of the things that seems very difficult about creating a product like this is making sure that the hash rate is there and available for the exchange between both parties. Because at the end of the day, like running a mining facility, it can be very difficult to make sure every machine's online. And so it's like becoming the market leader, getting on it early and creating that hash rate is like a huge competitive advantage. It puts you in a great spot. And it's honestly something that if you want to see the industry evolve, it's needed, right? You need something like this to eventually get created, and it will be created at if I were to fast forward in a number of years. So with all that said, like the way that you are looking at it, how do you see this type of liquid marketplace around hash rate evolving?
That's certainly a challenge, is how do you guarantee the delivery of hash rate? Maybe the grid has very high pricing, and so that mining farm drops down to sell back power to the grid, or maybe there's issues with machines. As we know, it's impossible to keep 100% of your machines running 100% of the time. One way to abstract away from that is to do cash settlement of these derivatives, either in US dollar or Bitcoin, in which you're just trading based on the value of that hash rate rather than actually hash rate changing hands. So I think that's an easier path to market, and you don't have to attack some of these big physical challenges like 100% hash rate guarantee and basically having a hash rate clearinghouse to guarantee that level of hash rate. That being said, I think in the future, there'll be a myriad of different products, cash settled, physically delivered, and they both have their value. On the physically delivered side, we do think that hash rate itself is a very unique commodity. It doesn't only represent the Bitcoin in which it can produce. It also represents governance on the Bitcoin network. As we saw with Taproot in last November, it was miners who voted for this network upgrade and signaled for the activation of Taproot. Taproot wasn't too controversial, but you know, there will be more controversial network upgrades in the future, kind of like what we saw with SegWit. And so in the future, we think commodity or hash rate is going to be treated at a premium in certain cases to the Bitcoin that it can mine because of that governance factor. Companies like Coinbase or Kraken will want some form of hash rate so that they can have a say and a seat at the table when these big decisions come on the network that, you know, they derive the majority of their revenue from. So I'm going down a deep rabbit hole here, but long story short, I think there'll be a few different products that exist.
Well, one of the things that I actually don't think we've covered it on this podcast yet, if you want to talk a little bit of Taproot and, you know, what it is and why you think it might be important, that might be a good foundation to lay. But I think what you're saying regarding, you know, some of these other players getting involved and potentially using hash rate to get involved is really fascinating. But yeah, why don't I give it to you for Taproot?
Maybe I'll start with SegWit too, just because it kind of leads into like this whole theme of network upgrades. SegWit came about, I think, almost like a half decade now. Time's really flying here. But basically, that was our first taste of a network upgrade that relied on miners kind of supporting what the Bitcoin community, the Bitcoin core developers, and kind of general community wanted in terms of an upgrade. And there was a lot of debate around the activation of that upgrade, different, like, you know, BIP8, BIP9, basically signifying like, how does a network upgrade get proposed and then actually put into place? And some of those proposals were more miner focused. Some of them were more user focused, would be like the people who run Bitcoin nodes. Ultimately, the miners kind of fumbled that. I think it was in 2016, back when miners weren't very active in contribution of the overall Bitcoin network. And so a lot of people gain like a distrust for miners as viable partners to push forward new network upgrades or turn them down when necessary. That being said, you know, fast forward to 2021, Taproot was kind of the next major network upgrade, included a lot of things around like privacy of Bitcoin and enabling new smart contracts, DLCs, and DeFi to be built on top of Bitcoin. It had been out for a few years in debate and really gained a lot of momentum in the Bitcoin community. And there was, I would say, like near perfect consensus that it was good for Bitcoin. There wasn't a lot of strong opponents left by summer of last year. And so it became clear that the miners needed to support this, or else, again, miners would be at odds with the general Bitcoin community. And so this time, miners and mining pools really went forward with it. There was a website called Taproot Activation. And basically, miners were kind of signaling to the market through pools, you know, if they wanted to activate this or not. And there was a few pools that kind of didn't have their act together and took a while to figure out how to activate it. But overall, it got done in November last year. And so miners have since regained the trust of the overall Bitcoin community and will probably be more active participants in governance moving forward, which is kind of relates to that point where, you know, miners are really important to the network for that reason. And hash rate is the underlying commodity that supports that.
That's fascinating. And thank you for explaining that. So when we talk about what Taproot allows, right, you talked about privacy, DeFi on Bitcoin. I feel like a lot of people obviously know DeFi with things outside of Bitcoin, not necessarily like on things like any other chain, really. Like DeFi and Bitcoin don't really seem to go hand in hand. So from your perspective, or like based on what you've heard, what's being worked on was allowed from Taproot, or is there anything else that in regards to like privacy or DeFi on Bitcoin that you're excited about?
I first started hearing about discrete log contracts, DLCs, a couple of years ago. My friends out of Toronto were building Atomic Finance. And they had a smart contract based on the US election at the time, which is actually a really interesting oracle because there was, you know, obviously some debate for some period of time of what took place there. But they built a smart contract on Bitcoin that basically settled on the Bitcoin network based on the elections. And since that point, which was January, I guess, of 2021, so, you know, coming up a year and a half plus now, I think the majority of at least the uses I've seen have been on derivative side. Actually, I spoke with a company today that's looking at creating derivatives on network difficulty, on gold, real estate, and some other commodities directly through DLCs. I would say there isn't widespread adoption yet. I don't understand that the technicalities too much and like the limitations there, but it's clear that the volume of DeFi on Bitcoin is very small relative to Ethereum. But that's also something that as miners, we need to care about and really need to support. With a decreasing block reward every 4 years, it's really crucial that transaction fees pick up the pace here from at least where they've been since the China ban of last year. And so getting more applications and products built on Bitcoin is a huge net positive for miners. We run an Ethereum mining pool. It's been fascinating to see how much of the mining revenue comes from transaction fees, MEV, and tips. There is like the Bored Ape Yacht Club, whatever, metaverse print earlier this summer. And we hit an Ethereum block that had 200 Ethereum in it as part of tips. And the block reward's only 2 ETH. So it was 100x in you know, transaction fees equivalent. And so that type of future, I think, is really important for Bitcoin. We need to fund and develop as many platforms being built on this as possible. And it's going to lead to higher transaction fees, which then leads to more security and network spend. People like you and I will go out, we'll spend more money to secure the network every day, buy more land, buy more infrastructure, energy machines, and you know, keep pushing forward Bitcoin as the most secure network out there.
Yeah, it's so crazy to think about because, I mean, logically, we know the last Bitcoin is going to be mined in the year 2140. And the block reward at that time is going to be, I mean, you would know better than, was it going to be like one Bitcoin for the entire year or half a Bitcoin, something like that? Yeah. So almost nothing, basically. And so when you think about it logically, you're like, okay, well, how is the mining network going to be sustained? Obviously, you're going to need a much higher Bitcoin price, but you're going to need it to be honestly long before have already achieved like global reserve status or just be that underlying layer one to the financial system. At least that's my own prediction. Like one of the reasons why Bitcoin has so much value and can achieve everything that we will talk about when we say reserve currency status or decentralization is because of mining, right? You have this economic actor that's involved in the consensus mechanism that makes Bitcoin function. So the mining network, there's a lot of economic value going into that. Now, all of a sudden, if you wipe out the mining part of Ethereum, you just wiped out a large economic actor that is supporting your ecosystem. And so, I mean, to get more granular and not as broad strokes, when you think about it, let's say that you're using any of these applications. You talk about, you know, all these valuable applications that are being used on top of Ethereum. If you want to transact using these applications, you need to have Ethereum to do so. And so if the transaction fees are really high, then you're paying a lot of money to acquire more Ethereum to continue using the applications that are built on top. And so how does that play out? Well, it plays out with if the transaction fees come way down, then yes, you can use all those applications that are built on top, but they might not be as secure because you just removed the mining network, the decentralization or tornado cash factor that we've seen play out recently. It's like, how secure is the base layer? And then on top of that, there's not as much demand that you have for buying actual Ethereum to utilize all the applications. And so what happens to the price of Ethereum, the full proof of stake chain? And so these are all the things that I was thinking through.
But that's a great point. Like a lot of the criticism of proof of work, false criticism is that it's not scalable. There really isn't like consensus that proof of work is less scalable than proof of stake. You can look at ADA and BSC as an example of that, or BSV rather, you know, the transaction throughput's higher. But as you highlighted, it's a trade-off. You can have very high throughput and close to zero transaction fees, but you're sacrificing your security. Nothing in life is free. And so if you do want a secure network, you need to pay for it. And I think that's what Bitcoin's model is pretty good at right now, is there's a lot of reward going out to Bitcoin miners, and it's encouraging people to travel across the world to buy land and plug into a electricity grid, buy machines, mortgage, you know, their house to go fund a new mining venture. Like every day we wake up to compete to add more security to the network. That's all I can think about is how do I get more hash rate? Yeah, that was a great point that you brought up there.
So that's interesting. I actually on the podcast haven't spoken with anyone who's been to El Salvador and utilized Bitcoin in transactions or the Lightning Network. So, I mean, maybe to start, do you want to talk about the approach that El Salvador has taken, how they're utilizing the Lightning Network? And then we can kind of dive into how it actually is functioning on the ground.
My understanding with El Salvador is that they moved off their own currency some time ago to use the US dollar, which a lot of countries have. You know, it's very hard to, in some of these developing nations, run your own central bank, protect yourself from rampant inflation like we're seeing in Argentina. And so sometimes moving to a US dollar is like a band-aid, I guess, on some of the issues that you're running into. Those types of societies, I think, are easier to adopt Bitcoin because they already don't have a central bank that can print unlimited currency. They can't just print $10 million in US dollars, right? And so going to a Bitcoin standard is actually an easier pill for them to swallow. The people in El Salvador, I would say, you know, it's an older generation of people. And so it's not kind of what you see in like a Nigeria, for example. So it's not primed for technology adoption, but the government put in place some incentives for that to happen, including if they downloaded the government Bitcoin wallet, which includes a Lightning wallet, you know, they'd get $15 equivalent in Bitcoin, which to a lot of the people there is a lot of money. And so that's kind of like taking a page out of like PayPal and Venmo's book, right? PayPal just gave $20 free to everyone. And now suddenly everyone in the US has it. It's a really nice like bootstrapping mechanism for a payment wallet. And so every vendor you see there, at least in San Salvador and El Zante, where we spent the most amount of time, has a Bitcoin wallet. Restaurants, taxis, clothing stores, everything. And so, yeah, the adoption of both Bitcoin and Lightning Network there was unbelievable to see.
Is there like an app that you would just use? Everyone has smartphones and then it's basically like a Stripe or like just a very simple, normal digital checkout?
Yeah, you can use your own wallet, right? Doesn't need to be like anything compatible. We're all using the Lightning Network. I would say the majority of the folks that we saw there that were accepting Bitcoin and Lightning was using their country wallet. I think it's called Chavo, but also like Jack Mallers and some others have done a lot of work there. So there was some variety. But of course, we go in with, you know, a variety of like Blue Wallet or others. So I would say like the majority of like locals use their government wallet there.
Okay, so that's fascinating. So there's the government wallet and then you can use any wallet to just interact with the government wallet, like that app.
Yeah, just use the Lightning Network. I mean, all you have to do is get their address, simple as that.
That's incredible to see. Because a lot of times when you're talking about Bitcoin adoption, you'll speak with people and they'll say, hey, well, you know, you can understand it and I can understand it, but the general population isn't going to understand it. And what's crazy to me is like, if your life's on the line or if your livelihood's on the line, you'll figure it out. Humans, we're very adaptable animals. And then on top of that, it's not like everyone knows how the internet works, but everyone still has found a way to utilize the internet or find some sort of benefit from it. So I feel like you have those types of dynamics at play. And it's not like every single person is going to understand how to run a Bitcoin node, but people are going to be able to, as proven by your trip, be able to figure out how to interact with these types of technologies.
And what's encouraging too is not every vendor auto converts to US dollar or stablecoin. And so you're making this payment to a side vendor for, you know, $1 equivalent worth of Bitcoin. They don't go and auto convert that. A lot of them are holding Bitcoin as treasury for their business or for their personal stuff. So that was really awesome to see. And encouraging.
So I also want to talk about what we touched on earlier briefly is like Tornado Cash, right? And so with Tornado Cash, let's first talk about like what the protocol actually was and then the reaction by the governments to what it was being used for and kind of take it from there. Because it was one thing where when I was looking at it, it's not like I was surprised by the outcome, but it was almost like, okay, well, a line was just drawn, you know, like this seems like it was crossing a line and was something that could be stopped. And so it's crazy to see it playing out right in front of us here.
I never used Tornado Cash. And actually, it was the first time I'd heard of it when it got banned. So
that's the first I heard of it, too.
I'll never have the chance to use it. But I mean, it's a mixer. So similar to like a mixer you'd see like, you know, Wasabi or whatever on Bitcoin, but based on Ethereum. And so basically, it makes anyone who uses it much more anonymous. It kind of hides away some of the public tracking that can be done on public blockchains through addresses. And it's just, it makes overall it hard to track different wallets and who owns what wallet. And so there's a multitude of reasons why people would use this. At its most simple case, people want to remain private. They don't need the whole world to know exactly what they're doing in their personal life. And not all those people are criminals, as much as the government sometimes wants to label privacy as all criminals, but there's a lot of folks, normal people that just want privacy in their life. Same reason why, you know, you have a closed door and you're behind your house. Like, it's not that you're cooking up meth in your house. It's just like, hey, I don't want the entire world seeing me. But there's also other reasons, like, you know, you don't want people to front run your trades on DeFi applications. You know, they track, like, if you're a fund, maybe let's use a funny example, like Three Arrows Capital, and people are like trying to front run your trade, right? Like, you don't want them to know every single address you have, because you don't want every trade to be front run. And then, of course, there is the illicit aspect to it. It's like, it'd be foolish not to acknowledge that. Like, there are obviously people doing illicit things deemed by certain governments on these blockchains. It just exists, as it does with US dollar and other currencies too. So there's a few different reasons, but obviously the US government doesn't like these things because programs like Chain Analysis have a really hard time tracking down criminals that use them, but now they're banning it from use from everyone. So basically they're targeting criminals, but now everyone's getting, you know, their privacy taken away from them. And what I see is like a fundamental right to be private in your financial transactions. But yeah, it's unfortunate the way it's gone here. And I don't think it'll be the last time we see infractions on privacy by various governments around the world.
Yeah. I mean, I was just like you, I first heard about it, like when it was getting banned, and now you're looking at the developer, like I think the lead developer on it, who's getting arrested because he was part of the project and, you know, was being used by a legal actor. So you have this big debate where a lot of people who are very freedom oriented and saying, hey, like, this is my right, like, I want to have privacy on my transactions, all of a sudden now they're being looped in because it was being used for some illicit activities. And I heard that there was like a wallet out there that was sending like small microtransactions to a bunch of like wallets of like famous like influencers, like Shaq and Logan Paul and things like that, just almost making a mockery out of it, right? Because like, what are all of a sudden now all those wallets that received a little bit of ETH from the Mixer band, like, are those now also sanctioned wallets? It's kind of difficult because it's almost like freedom of speech, but instead of speech, it's like code, right? It's like, it's kind of hard to draw the analogy, but it's like, how are you going to ban open source code or open source technology that anyone can plug into? It's like those people, the famous celebrities who have their wallets, like people know the address and were sent this Ethereum. It's not like they were any way involved with the Mixer, right? But all of a sudden now their wallet holds some of that Ethereum. So it's kind of crazy. I don't know how it's going to play out, but it makes you think, right? Because I almost view what's happening in outside of the Bitcoin ecosystem and in DeFi as a testing ground for what's eventually going to be built and implemented on Bitcoin. That's my own personal view. I could be completely wrong. But if you take that view, then if you're in the Bitcoin community, you look at that and you're like, okay, well, you know, what lesson can you learn? And when something like that gets implemented on Bitcoin, what's the best way to do it? The good thing about Bitcoin is that you do have that secure base layer. I like to say it's like the most secure network in the entire world. Nowhere else has that type of incentive as the Bitcoin network.
Yeah. You raise good points there. I mean, it won't end with Tornado Cash. There's a lot of mixers out there that are all targets now, as well as other areas of the stack too. And I think what's important for regulators, especially here in the US, to realize is that you can ban your own people from interacting with these things, whether it's a ban of using Tornado Cash or even ban of mining, but you can't stop it. You can only stop it inside your own borders. And so as a government, like the US government, you have a decision to make. Do you want to be an important part of a new global financial system like Bitcoin, or do you want to force all the miners to go to Kazakhstan, Iran, Latin America, Northern Europe, and really kind of be out of your control? And so I think that when regulators step back and kind of really hear from domain experts on this and kind of listen to reason, they realize they should have a seat at the table. And so they should be encouraging the development of Bitcoin mining and not forcing it overseas. And you know, that there's certainly a slippery slope here that starts with Tornado Cash and goes all the way down into mining, where transactions need to become KYC in order to add them to a block, in which case that would destroy the entire US mining industry. So yeah, I think this is going to be an interesting battle for us on Capitol Hill and educating these regulators and helping them, you know, provide a good path forward for them.
So I'm going to ask you a question here, and it's going to be like an educational type of question, like an educational piece. Let's say I give you a magic wand, right? And you wave that magic wand and you're in charge of the what happens, like how regulators approach the mining industry in the US, taking everything that you know, all the knowledge that, you know, no single like governmental official would really have the time to go and learn. If you were to go and give the prescription for what the regulators should do for the mining industry, in the United States, what type of regulation would you put in place? Like what would the industry look like? What type of rules would you try and implement?
There's two main ones that are top of mind. Obviously more than that too, but two I'll focus on just given timing. So the first is around this idea of like censoring transactions within the Bitcoin block itself. I think this is kind of a fool's effort to ban and censor Bitcoin from happening within the United States. And so I would urge regulators, or if I was a regulator, I'd put this in place where transactions are fungible in the block. Miners can mine whichever block they want and don't need to censor certain transactions being put into them, basically making transactions fungible within the Bitcoin blockchain. So I think that's the number one thing. And then number two is more around like energy, which I guess we're opening up another can of worms here. But as you saw with the New York bill, it's still ongoing, a proposal to target certain miners that use a certain energy source. While I'm obviously supportive of efforts to fight climate change and build renewable energy, I do think it's dangerous for a government to target a certain form of compute power with a certain form of energy. So if, for example, if you're in New York and you plug in a machine that is producing video rendering for Netflix or, you know, some other worse video site, that's okay. But if you plug in a computer that's performing the SHA-256 algorithm, then that's not allowed. And so it sets a very dangerous precedent where leaders can come in, be lobbied by whichever political group they want, and then determine, okay, this form of compute power is banned, this form isn't. And you can see examples of how that breaks down in a lot of developing nations. You know, countries like Jordan have different electricity prices based on whether you're a pizza shop or a kebab shop, because the kebab shop lobby is, you know, more important than the government. It creates this multi-tiered system that breaks down into chaos. And so it's very crucial that miners treat all forms of compute power equal. If you're going to put a ban on Bitcoin mining using fossil fuels, you should just put a ban on everyone using fossil fuels. And yeah, that is quite a dangerous precedent that New York is trying to set right now. And I think something that the US should definitely stay away from as kind of a developed and bureaucratic and hopefully a good rule of law country.
That's another big piece. And you're right, it is another can of worms, but I am really fascinated by it, is this whole conversation around like energy use. I mean, for example, even I've already kind of noticed on like Twitter and these other areas, the conversation starting to pick up around energy use and mining, which was already picking up. But now all of a sudden, like now that Ethereum is going off of proof of work and fully into proof of stake, now that just becomes a full another attack vector, I feel like, on Bitcoin, where let's say that you were part of the Ethereum community. And as much as we hate to say it, there is kind of like a religious aspect to it. It's like, okay, I'm into Ethereum, I'm into Bitcoin, whatever it may be. I feel like as soon as you take Ethereum off of that proof of work mechanism, there's just a whole nother large group of people that now have like, who before couldn't have said, hey, we're going to attack Bitcoin for its energy use. Now, all of a sudden, now that Ethereum's not using it, I just feel like that it's a conversation that's starting to pick up. And, you know, I really am curious, and I don't know the right answer here, but what ends up happening on this conversation around energy and Bitcoin mining? I mean, what you mentioned happening in New York is crazy, and it does set a crazy precedent, and it really does put the US at a disadvantage. So, you know,
yeah.
What are your thoughts on all that?
It's it's an interesting topic to follow. Bitcoin has done a really good job at highlighting the positive impact of mining on renewable energy infrastructure and energy infrastructure in general. As the world forgot that at the center of our universe is energy until like last year when energy prices started skyrocketing around the Russia-Ukraine crisis. We've done a good job in the Bitcoin community pushing forward. This is what Bitcoin mining can do for renewable energy. We can do flared gas, we can reduce output and ultimately push forward our system. That same type of research and marketing hasn't been done in Ethereum, but is in some ways the exact same. Of course, it's a different system. 85-90% of the Ethereum network is run by GPUs. So there's a much larger retail base, much more traditional, but it also has a very positive impact on energy and data center infrastructure, which is crucial to the security of a country. And so if you're a country that's trying to incentivize Google to come in and place a large data center with tens of thousands of GPUs, Google wants some level of comfort, or I'm just using them as an example, but any cloud compute wants some level of comfort that they can sell the compute power in which they're installing. So you have 10,000 GPUs, you need to make sure that there's, you know, a dozen universities using you for AI testing. You need to make sure that local networks are hooked up to you. YouTube is going to use you for video rendering, whatever it may be. Oftentimes, it's impossible to get 100% utilization of your data center. And so where do you turn to? Well, There's a buyer that's 24/7 of compute power, no questions asked, and that's Ethereum. At any point, anyone can turn on a GPU and start mining Ethereum, utilizing their GPUs that are unused and start making a return. And so it encourages development of data centers to come in and build capacity. And so there's this positive spin on mining in Ethereum that no one touches on. And so the community is kind of labeling this move to proof of stake as good for the environment, while I say the opposite. I think there's going to be less investment in data center technology in, you know, countries, and there's going to be less, you know, use of renewable energies that can use a 24/7 flexible demand response form of compute. So that's my rant there.
No, that was incredible. I've actually never heard the explanation on the Ethereum side, but that was really interesting to hear that. Because yeah, I mean, this whole conversation, it reminds me of what I spoke about with Brandon Quittam on this podcast. He's one of our advisors and is, you know, helping grow Swan Bitcoin. And what he's talking about and writing about is how Bitcoin miners are like the pioneer species. So you can kind of think about how the Bitcoin miners will go and bootstrap energy assets in different locations where, you know, there wouldn't be that type of investment or commercialization to even bring that energy online. Suddenly, now you have an energy source. You need people to work and make that energy source function. And those people need like a community around them. So the incentive of Bitcoin mining is incentivizing people to go and build out more energy sources where the Bitcoin miners will utilize that energy. But eventually, as that place gets more developed, you'll see the miners be economically competitive in that location anymore and go and pioneer a new asset or a new area to utilize energy. And I mean, that's obviously a huge benefit, right? Because how do you improve people's standards of living? Well, it's not by getting rid of the electrification of the grid. It's not by getting rid of your access to energy. It's by going and harnessing energy in a better way. The Ethereum side of things, I think, is very interesting as well, where the proof of stake, you're killing that. You're killing that pioneer species in a way that's going and, you know, trying to push forth innovation and I guess the data center side of things. Yeah, that was really interesting to hear you talk through the Ethereum side.
I think it's really important that the Bitcoin and Ethereum communities don't relentlessly attack each other. We've seen some, obviously, Bitcoin members trying to go after Ethereum for being labeled as a security. And as it moves to proof of stake, obviously, it does look increasingly like a security. And then obviously, there's members of the Ethereum community going after Bitcoin for its energy consumption and perceived harm on the environment. Either way, I think it's bad for the overall ecosystem. If Bitcoin attacks Ethereum and Ethereum goes down with regulators, the next in line is Bitcoin for some whatever reason. If Ethereum attacks Bitcoin for energy use, Bitcoin goes down, so will Ethereum. So in some other capacity, like, our efforts really should not be focused on attacking each other, regardless of, you know, philosophical beliefs of consensus mechanisms. Really, like, we should just be focused on building the best networks possible. And if you don't like the other network, just try and ignore them and build your own.
Well, in terms of just the overall geopolitics that are involved, we've been talking about regulation, right? But there are certain things right now happening in the world that are just unbelievable. Like, we're living in like a black swan era, it feels like, right? And so we mentioned like the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And one thing that I personally am not sure how it affects the mining industry, like what happens in this event, then I'm about to ask you this question. But let's say you see China invade Taiwan, right? I mean, you're looking at the hub for what is really just the backbone of not only the mining industry, but so many industries around the world, right? With the semiconductors. And so if you see an invasion of China into Taiwan, I mean, we've already been seeing supply chain constraints with COVID, supply chain constraints with the conflict that's escalated with Russia, Ukraine. How do you think an invasion into Taiwan would end up playing out? And you could mention like how you think it plays out globally, but also like what do you think the ramifications on the mining network are in that type of a scenario? It's a very tough question.
It is. There's so many angles I could take this. One of the most interesting books I've ever read was On China by Kissinger, who was part of like Nixon's government. Nixon sent him to China to improve relations with China and the US at the time. It was very hostile. So he was a very big China historian. There's a lot of takeaways from that book, but one thing is that China moves very slowly. They're usually not a nation that is going to send amphibious vehicles and land on, you know, the beaches of Taiwan to take over. It would be more of like a political slow takeover, somewhat what we've seen in Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong's supposed to be handed over in 2047. Obviously, it's slowly becoming, you know, handed over to China before then. And so if there is kind of a takeover of Taiwan, I expect it to be political in nature, slower and not by brute force. That's usually not the Chinese method of expansion. And they're not always the most expansionary people too. Obviously, Taiwan's a special case where it used to be unified. Taiwanese people are ethnically Chinese. So it is, a different example there, but I don't expect like a rapid takeover. Regardless, having TSMC, which is today one of the most advanced semiconductor foundries out there, they're heading into the 3-nanometer setup by end of this year. Based there is key consideration for the United States. It's become clear that semiconductor production onshore is vital to national security if you're a big country. And so that's why it seems like the United States is rushing to get TSMC and Samsung to build foundries onshore in the United States and also encourage other semiconductor production in the United States too. To my last knowledge, that's expected to start happening in 2024, probably like not set up until 2025. And so I think the chances that the United States lets China come into Taiwan and any kind of material capacity before then is limited, just given that, you know, they need to protect their supply of chips. I mean, TSMC is the biggest supply of Apple chips out there. If suddenly China controls the chips going into Apple phones, that's a big security threat for the United States government. So I don't think they can let that happen for another few years, at least. If it were to happen, let's say, whether it's, you know, next year or 2030 or whatever, the mining industry, I think, will adapt. There's still kind of legacy Chinese foundries that go into chips that end up in on the American grid. For example, SMIC, which is an OFAC sanctioned company now, is a semiconductor company based on mainland China. They supply chips to Canon, the Avalon units, which are bought by a lot of Americans and then put onto grids like ERCOT. That hasn't been cracked down upon yet, but I think if things escalate with China, like certainly American regulators and government is not going to like SMIC chips operating on their electricity grids, which are the backbone of society. You know, situation escalates, I think there'll be a wide crackdown of any chips coming out of China, including if they took over Taiwan, the chips coming out of Taiwan. So it would have a huge impact on the relationship between manufacturers in China and U.S. customers, which represent the lion's share of their new purchases.
Well, hearing you say that does make me feel a lot better. Just like a sigh of relief. Because yeah, I didn't realize that the background on Kissinger and the way that China normally approaches these things, as well as the incentive you mentioned with the US, like basically if it did come to that type of a conflict, having a huge vested stake to not let that fall. That's good to know. And so I want to move on to the a little bit more policy driven or policy centered conversation on what's happened with the Inflation Reduction Act and some of the incentives that are getting put in place. Like in all transparency, I haven't gone and dove into it that much, but I had a conversation with one of our advisors the other day who's in the solar industry talking about how there are a lot of ramifications coming from this for the U.S. solar industry. And so as quick context, as we know, China has done a lot to help support their domestic solar industry and renewables, and that has given them an advantage over other countries internationally. And so to my understanding, what has just recently happened is that there's been this huge push within the government in the U.S. to try and help support the solar industry here in the U.S., and renewable energy. And that's pretty much the extent of my understanding of it as it stands right now. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the act in total or the ramifications on renewable energy here in the US.
So the Inflation Act, which really should be called the Climate Change Act, I mean, mostly, I think, what is it, like 75% of spending or something like that is heading towards climate change initiatives rather than reducing inflation, which itself is kind of a weird thing to do, spending more money to reduce inflation. But okay, regardless, like focusing on the climate change aspect, I think this is a huge net positive for Bitcoin miners, specifically because it's going to funnel a lot of money into renewable energy products, solar, like you mentioned, other platforms like wind and geothermal. And so that's naturally a good thing for Bitcoin mining because it's a symbiotic relationship. Renewable energy needs flexible load like Bitcoin mining to really monetize their assets. You go to West Texas right now, for the majority of times in which wind is blowing, a lot of those windmills are shut off. The wind's blowing, but it's because there's no demand at that time in that rural area for that renewable energy. And so it's really important that you get a flexible load close to your renewable energy site to offtake some of that energy. And it makes the whole project that much more viable and way more economic. So renewable energy needs Bitcoin mining and flexible load. And then Bitcoin mining benefits from subsidies in renewable energy, as does, you know, any other industry. there's a lot of money there to get in as investors or partner with. I think it's going to be really good for Bitcoin miners in the United States. And then it's going to be good for Bitcoin elsewhere too, because I mean, this is kind of a pessimistic view. I don't usually like to have pessimistic views, but like this act does nothing for inflation. In fact, it might actually increase inflation. So it becomes increasingly clear why there needs to be an alternative global financial system that's not dictated by, you know, a handful of people on Capitol Hill to determine how everyone else is going to live their lives and, you know, save with their currency. And so it's going to be a net positive for Bitcoin mining. And it's going to be a net positive for Bitcoin, in my view.
Yeah. When you were just talking through that there, it reminded me of this thought I had the other day, which was when you think about it, Bitcoin, it's not like there's a marketing department. It's not like there's a individual CEO or a company pushing it forward. It's almost like it's open source code, but it's like an idea that goes and it wins the hearts and minds of people. And more people learn about all the aspects involved and realize, hey, this is a huge technology solution to a lot of problems that you see today. And whenever you see something like inflation or these types of acts that are passed that involve a lot of money printing and supporting certain industries, but also really in a weird way, having an aspect of theft of the everyday person who's holding dollars, it's like a big marketing campaign for Bitcoin, right? It's like the more that people see this happening, it's like these dollars are almost like the marketing campaign behind Bitcoin. It's like, it forces people to say, wait, what's going on here? Like, where's this money coming from? Like, how does this whole system work? And when you really understand how everything works, it puts forth a good case for Bitcoin. And it shows the value of Bitcoin mining. You're not just looking at Bitcoin mining when you understand all this as just a wasted energy source, wasting energy, using the same amount of energy as certain countries. You're realizing, wait, this is the foundation to, in a big way, improve the world in many different ways, to improve the way that the financial system works, to improve the actual custody of assets, right? There's so many different things that are behind Bitcoin that people end up learning because of things like this getting passed. And in a weird way, as we were talking through it, it makes me think, wow, this was almost like a huge win for the Bitcoin community, even though Bitcoin isn't necessarily directly stated anywhere in the bill.
It is, yeah. Yeah. The corporate taxes obviously, I think, increase under this bill. So for companies operating in the US, you know, that might hurt, but overall, in my view, a huge net positive.
This was an awesome conversation. You brought up so many things that I like, so many new ideas that I've never heard before, but that all make complete sense. So I appreciate you, you know, going and bringing all those to the table here. And yeah, man, we'll have to run it back again soon. And hopefully we run into each other at another conference again soon.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. That was a fun conversation.
Yeah, for sure, man.